we get on board the telephone and welcome into the program our friend, the multi-talented writer, Colin Fleming. Hello, Colin.
Hey, what's up, buddy?
By my count, you have logged about 700 miles, 50, 60,000 steps in the monument, and written about 7 masterworks in the last 3 days. Is that about right?
Yeah, your stats are pretty close to accurate there. 35 climbs in 5 days, and that's 41,000 stairs, and yeah, lots of things written. Lots and lots of things written. Not as many things written as stairs climbed, but things written count for more than stairs, right?
Well, yes, absolutely. And a piece in the Washington Post that we're going to be talking about largely today, and that's 4th of July themed literature. I didn't know there were so many options, first of all.
Well, the options are always out there, my friend, if you know where to look for them, right? You can find options for anything. And the theme, I guess, kind of this piece is the idea of, well, first of all, it's just tiresome to me that people always say, when you ask them their interest, they say the exact same two things. And so I wanted to provide something that can let their imaginations roam a little further afield, and with an emphasis on freedom, not just freedom in what you're going to read, but freedom in trying something a little bit new. You have the ability to do that, so why not make the most of it? So I dialed in on about 10 or so books and stories and young adults and children stuff that I thought people would find pretty good 4th of July fare.
My interests are pina coladas and getting caught in the rain, but these also look very appealing to me. Starting at number 10 on your list, Ben Franklin's autobiography.
Yeah, Franklin. I enjoy a lot of Franklin. And the thing about Franklin is you think, if you don't read Franklin, like, oh dear, I'm an old guy and from a different time and written in this old-fashioned prose, and I am not going to dig this. And that's not true. Franklin was a lot of fun, and he was a total wise-ass. He was very sardonic, and he was very sagacious. And I find that a really heady, appealing blend that you don't get with a lot of people. You don't get a lot anywhere, really, in this life at the moment. And he reads fantastically modernly. He's bawdy, certainly, and he's someone who came up by his own bootstraps, found his own way, and he was something that really connects with me, and that's a person who wasn't just pigeonholed in one single area. He wasn't someone who thought in terms of can't. It was always why not, and yes, I can. And he ranged pretty far in his studies, his manner of speaking, his styles of writing, his humor, everything. He just was a really fun, smart guy, smarter than almost anyone that this country has ever had. And it's a great read, great fun read, and I thought it was a perfect 4th of July type of book.
We'll come back to Franklin a little later on the list. At number 9, something from Robert Frost.
I don't even remember. What was that one? Oh, right.
North of Boston.
Yes, Frost. You know, Frost is kind of this, he's sort of who you think is a good poet if you don't really know what good poetry is, right? I've used this example before, and people don't like it, but it's like Led Zeppelin is your idea of just the best ever rock band when you're 15. Robert Frost is kind of the poet's Led Zeppelin. But he was very good at capturing New England outside. You're in the woods. And I would say if you have a family and you just do the standard cookout thing, and that's fun and everything every 4th of July, but work in a hike in these New England woods. You read these Frost poems and he would find these stone walls, right? I don't know if they have them up in Maine, but
in
Massachusetts. You're out in the woods. It's like, oh, what was here? What?
Right.
This was like the edge of somebody's property where neighbors gathered over a lager. That's just a really quintessentially New England idea that's captured well in this book.
I have not read this, but I feel like I have to now. Number 8, A Civil War Nurse.
Civil War what?
Civil War Nurse.
Ah, yes. I don't even know which one I put there. Was Civil War what?
Civil War Nurse, The Diary and Letters of Hannah Ropes.
Oh,
Ropes.
Right. Nerf. I thought you were saying Nerf, like Nerf football. I'm like, oh, I like Nerf. Yeah, around.
Also a fine read as well.
Yeah, Civil War Nurse. And that is a wonderful account of I don't think that there are many people in this country who deserve our respect more than nurses. And I'm a hypochondriac myself, and whenever I've had to go to the ER because of my stress and my heart rate is going too fast, the nurses that you are fronted with are always these angels of reassurance, really, who all seem so good at their job. And that was a very important thing to be, of course, during the Civil War. And the Civil War, to me, more than the Revolutionary War, is the defining war of the Republic. That is the most endemically American war because of what was at stake. Eventually, we were going to figure things out with the British, but I don't know that we were eventually going to figure things out with this country's great shame, slavery, if the Civil War hadn't transpired. So it's an account, a very readable account, a very you are in the trenches, sometimes quite literally account of someone who was a nurse at that time, who's caring for actually people on both sides of that battle. And I think sometimes people on the South side, they get lumped in as these villains, but you were just kind of going to fight on the side of wherever you happen to live. And it's a reminder of that, too. The people aren't always the monsters we think they are for reasons that we ascribe to them.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown about his Washington Post piece on great reads, 4th of July reads, and love to see one of the great sports writers of all time, but also a guy who broke the mold and wrote about other things, the wonderful Ring Lardner.
He was a great writer, and Fitzgerald worshipped him, and Hemingway kind of did for a while, but I don't really rate Hemingway as much of a writer, and I think he was pretty threatened by Lardner. But what Ring Lardner did was he wrote a baseball novel in stories called You Know Me, Al. And at the time, the biggest dream you could have had, it seems, this is like the 19-teens, so 100 years ago, essentially, was to grow up and be in Major League Baseball. It was the ultimate form of entertainment in our country's eyes. And it's about this borderline, like a 4A player, we call him now, who kind of belongs in the majors, but also sort of belongs in the minors, who's always conning his teammates. And his rhetorical flourish is, you know me, Al, like, you know me, Kimball, I'm good for the $50 you loan me. But of course, he never is. I wouldn't be. I'm poor. It's just what he says to people. He is branded as a busher. And a busher is someone who belongs in the bush leagues. But it was worse. It was something you could call someone back at the time to say, basically, you suck. You need to grow up. You're a busher. And it's this builder's Roman of this busher who you would think would pick up some lessons along the way. But what Lardner does is he writes in this conversational vernacular that no one was doing in literature at the time. He was deformalizing literature, and it was radical at the time that anyone would even turn sports into art, but this sort of vernacular into an art as well.
I want to move up on the list, and something you've written about in greater detail, Orson Welles' Moby Dick Rehearsed.
Yes, Welles wrote this one play, and nobody knows this play. And this play is one of his towering artistic achievements with Citizen Kane and the sketchbooks and Chimes at Midnight. It's pun sort of intended. It's called Melville, as in a simulacrum of Melville, where Wells has these actors, and they are doing Shakespeare, which Wells loved. And before they get into whatever Shakespeare play they're doing, they start tooling around with Moby Dick. And they end up getting so caught up in this story, because Melville really was a storyteller for all of the tautology and all of the philosophy, all of that. He was telling you a really ripping yarn. And they end up with no props doing Moby Dick. So they'll have, like, a broom as a harpoon and everything. And Wells would take his own imitation of Melville's language. He would take little bits from the novel itself, and he cobbled it together into this Melvillian stew, the Salmagundi of Melville. And it was just basically the purest iteration of the theater, the joy of making theater for not even an audience, but for yourself, for your fellow actor audiences. So I thought that was really just that deep-delved American theater theatrical spirit that Welles did so well. And he always had close ties to Melville. If you've seen John Huston's Moby Dick, he's Father Mapple in that. And it was just something that clearly meant a lot to him as an American.
At number two on your list, Robert Lawson's Ben and Me, in which we discover the inspiration, the source of some of Ben Franklin's, greatest bits of wisdom.
I love that book. It's a children's book, and there's a Disney cartoon from decades ago, too, that's based off of it. And every 4th of July, I'd be out at some neighbor's pool as a kid, and we had the Disney Channel, which I think is probably still a thing. It was a lot different thing back then. It was new. And I would be like, okay, I have to go. Ben and Me is on. I have to see this. And I loved it every year. People thought probably like, what is wrong with this kid? And it's this little mouse who supplies Franklin with all of his ideas. He lives in his pocket. And Franklin's like, oh, I don't know what to do today. And the mouse is like, I don't know, man. Why don't we fly a kite? Put some keys on storming out. See what happens. And Franklin's like, okay, fine. Great. You go up in the kite. You keep a lookout. And the mouse is like, whoa, no one ever said that, man. And it's just fun because ideas and what things become and the backstory for all of that isn't necessarily as simple as we tend to think it is. And yeah, it's just playful, it's whimsical, but it does plant that seed that for every great work of art, every great discovery, whatever it may be, there are a lot of different strands that go into the final cord of the rope. And it's a nice reminder of that in an American and spirited way.
I had number one on your list, and boy, you've written a lot about her lately, Billie Holiday's Lady Sings the Blues.
Yeah, I've wrote an op-ed about her. Coming up on the 60th anniversary of her death, I wrote about the final six songs she recorded 60 years ago, right before she died. A month before she died, it was right here in Boston, and it's now Pizzeria Uno. And this book was her autobiography, and it was ghostwritten. But the ghostwriter clearly spent a lot of time talking to her. And there are certain artists where people can write books about them, and they are in the spirit of that artist. I think The Love You Make, that biography about the Beatles from 1983, it wasn't written by the Beatles, but I almost think of it as a Beatles work of art, as though they did it, because their spirit was just so large that a number of things around that spirit would fall in its shadow. And this is a book along those lines about Billie Holiday, who had a horrible life. And I think she was a fascinating singer because no one ever says this, but the quality of her voice, even in her prime, wasn't that good. She is nowhere near tonally hems of her timbre, the singer somebody like Ella Fitzgerald was. But what Billie Holiday did so well is she communicated with you as a singer and she connected with you. I liken it to the sound of someone listening to you as you are unburdening yourself of the deepest things that make you who you are. She was the sound of that. And this book is the prose version of that sound. And she gave concert performances where she would read excerpts from it. And even though she's reading, it's very sing-song, it's very musical, it's just like her entire back catalog in this prose form that she would sing the language on stage.
Colin, you also sent along a part of a very unique novel. You've kind of created a new form here. It's called Musings with Franklin, and the whole thing is told in dialogue, and what I've read so far is absolutely fantastic and laugh-out-loud funny.
It's the only novel that is told completely in conversation. And it's a novel for the text-speak age, and it's about a guy named Ryder, and they just go by these handles, who believes he is dead and in hell. And he's not actually totally sure. He's trying to find out. And he thinks, and this makes a certain amount of sense, that when you die, you're not officially told, like, okay, it's happened, you're on the other side. You might have to sort that out, because it's probably not as simple as we think. And he's had something very tragic happen to him. And he's at a bar. It's a colonial-era bar in our modern times. And his companions are bartender and the perverted guy from the suburbs, who has a Subaru, who dresses up as Ben Franklin. And he is the well, he's the filthiest character in the history of literature. See, the things he says, it's like, whoa, oh my goodness. Like, yeah, it's the type of thing that if you were a 15-year-old high school hockey player, you would quote this endlessly. But if you were someone who wrote about literature for a living and wrote books on literature, you could say it's the novel of the text speak age. It's a kind of post-modernism. And the entire narrative is built up from the conversations they have with each other. So there's really never been, I've looked, any novel like it. There's nothing even a little bit like it. And of course, in publishing right now, that's a problem, because the idea that we connect with a million people if it hasn't been done over and over and over again makes people who make these decisions balk. But it is funny and tragic and unique, and the whip smart dialogue between these people is they rope in other characters, they share other stories, so you get other voices, not just the three of them, but it becomes this panoply of a novel that is just unlike anything that I've ever read myself. And yeah, it's not done yet, but eventually it'll be.
And I'm pretty sure I've seen Franklin leering at women in Quincy Market.
There was a guy who did dress up as Franklin. Now, if you had gone up to him, though, and said, like, hey, what's your brother James been up to? He'd be like, what? I have a brother James. I have a brother named Clint. Like, he just was this guy, this random guy who, it would be the summer, he would get a parasol, and
yes,
he'd be like, oh, Franklin today. So I'd see him around, but he's not this sagacious, unmasked pervert who has weird, like, Yoda-esque life wisdom to dispense. And really, too, it's a novel about friendship. And I think friendship is so rare, is true friendship, true support, truly listening, truly hearing. It's a novel about listening. These people don't hear each other. Now, they can be just horrible to each other and complete wise-asses to each other, but when one of them really needs the others, they have these bonding moments that are, you had remarked about something else, very no judgment. And that line of yours stuck in my head, and I was thinking about this one, and I said it to you. It's very no judgment, even when they are giving Franklin the absolute business for being the most debauched character in the history of literature.
Read Colin's work, his new piece in the Washington Post, and everything at ColinFlemingLit.com. Colin, we thank you as always. We'll check in with you again soon.
Okay, thank you.
Colin Fleming, Tuesdays on Downtown.